Well, I'd probably first have to tell people that no, I don't make bombs, because for some reason that's the first thing that everyone thinks, because they hear nuclear and immediately think of bombs. So I suppose the, how I'd say it is I use nuclear to help study the environment to support conservation efforts.
It's episode 43 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Janelle Williams. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, your favorite podcast about all types of diving, scuba, tech, freediving, and more. We cover it all. Every week on Monday, we post new episodes filled with diving news, interesting dive topics, ocean advocacy, and much more. To learn more about the show, find your favorite guest, or read about the hosts, check out our website, diveinpod.com. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm April.
I'm Nick, and we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast.
Mitt's not here tonight. He's unfortunately detained otherwise with, you know, that's that work thing, I guess.
Working's for suckers.
Working's for suckers. That's what I always say.
Yeah.
The hardest working person in this room.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do some work before I do some work before I go to bed tonight so I can get up early and do some work tomorrow before taking kids to school.
Poor Justin.
Nah. I'm exaggerating. I'm only going to do one thing of work, one unit of work. Anyway, I'm just talking.
One unit of work. What is this, Marxism?
Let's get back on track and meet our guest tonight. Tonight, we're speaking to Janelle Williams. Janelle is a Jamaican scientist with a background in ocean engineering and a diver who uses her underwater skills to support her research and passion for marine conservation. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, Janelle. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing pretty good. Thanks. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Trying not to freeze up here in cold, cold Canada.
Oh, dear. And I'm in warm Jamaica.
We'll start your interview in a few minutes here, Janelle. But before that, last week on the show, we had Sandra Klopp. She was a really great interview. Definitely lots going on with her, from cave diving to dive training to hunting for megalodon teeth. He's got a lot of irons in the fire, I guess.
It was a super fascinating interview, yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool. And she dives everywhere from down south to like really close to us. So really neat.
Yeah, maybe we'll see her at Belle Island next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or exactly. This year. We're in 2021. So,
yeah, it's a whole new year. Who knows? Anything could happen this year.
Anything could happen.
Also, we have the contest going on for the Shearwater Peregrine Dive Computer. That is pretty awesome. We've got our first round of six for the prize pack giveaways. As we've explained and everybody's heard, every entry you make is put into the grand prize drawing for that Peregrine in a few weeks. It's super awesome. Janelle, you entered. I saw that.
Yeah, I'm super excited.
It's a really awesome dive computer. Be fun to win. And those prize packs are really fun too. They have shirts and hats and all kinds of fun stuff.
And I think April was at the shop today when the decals came in, right? So I think we're probably going to throw in some decals in those prize packs as they go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely have to throw in some podcast stick. If you are looking for a sweet Dive in the Podcast sticker, shoot us a message, diveinthepodcast@gmail.com, and we'll let you know how you can get one. But before I ramble on too far, we should probably get to some news. And before I really get into the news, I got a question for you, Janelle. Have you ever stumbled across any fossils, maybe while diving or otherwise?
I haven't, actually. Nothing like strangely significant or anything, just, yeah, you know, your normal shells and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Well, two divers in Venice, Florida found not one, but two Colombian mammoth tusks. Well, I guess the mammoths have two tusks, so maybe it's not so crazy. But within a few weeks, the divers found the two tusks on different dives, and each diver found a different tusk. So they each have their own mammoth tusks, I guess, however that works.
Whoa.
So, Ryan Pico, one of the two divers, has only been scuba diving for less than 2 years, though he's been free diving for fossils since he was a child. Apparently, he's also found a nearly 6-inch megalodon tooth, as well as many mammoth bones. What they found was a Colombian mammoth fossil, and that lived between 1.5 million years ago and 11,000 years ago. So check out the show notes for a link to a video of the find. It's pretty cool.
I thought Sandra Klopp was saying last week that 7-inch megalodon tooth are like whole are pretty rare and pretty expensive. Like, I imagine finding a mammoth tusk to be probably just as exciting.
Yeah,
super exciting.
Yeah, I didn't quote the what the guy was quoted there from the article I read, but he was like, "Yeah, I've got to." I'm paraphrasing here, but he's like, "I got to make sure I don't run out of air from hyperventilating." That's it for the news today. It's time to dive in with Janelle Williams. So, Janelle, where are you from, and how would you describe what you do?
Hi. So I'm from Kingston, Jamaica, that nice small island that everyone knows for Bob Marley and Usain Bolt and awesome food. And what I do now is I'm a scientist here in Jamaica, specifically at the home of the only nuclear reactor in the English-speaking Caribbean, which I know everyone's going to kind of be like, wait, there's a reactor in the Caribbean? But it's just a research reactor, and we actually use it to do environmental stuff, kind of how I connect my diving experience to the field work that I do.
Well, we definitely have some plans to get some more information on that a little bit later on in this interview. But I want to start off asking, what was your first memory of the ocean?
Oh, man. Actually, there is a beach here, Hellshire. It's almost every Jamaican grew up going there, especially on a Saturday to get fried fish. And that's the first memory that I have. I think my parents still have that picture of me as a kid where I kind of ran away from my father to kind of go in the water. And I think I've been hooked ever since, because that kind of led to me wanting to learn how to swim, defying my parents and sneaking off for swim classes. And it's just kind of, I guess, was a catalyst for where I am today.
Right.
So I guess to go with that swimming story, your diving story does begin with swimming as a young girl. So can you tell us a little bit about that part of your journey?
Sure. So I started swimming early, like I mentioned, made national teams for water polo. I know that you had Irene on a couple of weeks ago. She was also a synchronized swimmer. I did that too. And I wanted to learn to scuba dive, but it's insanely expensive, especially when you think about converting the Jamaican currency to US dollars. It's even more expensive. So I didn't start that journey until I was in my undergrad. It was required. I was doing ocean engineering at Florida Tech. So I got the opportunity to kind of start my dive journey then. And it was pretty awesome. I mean, diving in Florida, how can you, not love that?
Prior to going to Florida to study and eventually scuba diving, was scuba diving always an interest of yours, always something that you wanted to do?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up watching Discovery and Nat Geo, and then my mom had a colleague who had a subscription to the Nat Geo magazines. I'm forever grateful to her because she'd give them to me. And I'd see all these cool pictures and was like, one day I'm going to have that experience. I still have it on my wall. I have a set of pictures of encounters that I want to have with turtles, with sharks, just kind of to see everything. So I'm slowly getting there. I'm not there yet.
Well, that's pretty awesome. I mean, one question I kind of had in the back of my mind is who would you look up to in the diving world? But I think just having sort of a montage of things you want to do in diving is probably just as epic. And obviously we got to know you through our previous guest, Christina Zanotto, in episode 37. That put us in touch with you. How did you two connect?
Pretty randomly, actually. It was in the process of kind of looking up people who were inspiring, people who were doing awesome things, especially through diving. And I kind of stumbled upon her profile. I was like, this lady is awesome. And I lost a bet with a friend who said that I had to kind of reach out to her. So I sent her an email. I didn't think she'd respond, and she actually did. And it kind of freaked me out, but I was super excited. And I don't know, we just kind of connected. From there, she invited me to come to the Bahamas. She trained me, so I'm now a rescue diver. She actually opened me up to my very first encounter with a Caribbean reef shark, so that was awesome. It kind of just literally went from someone I saw on the screen to someone I have a pretty good relationship with now, so it's kind of surreal.
Yeah,
it's pretty awesome.
What was it like learning from Christina?
It was awesome. It was intense because she does demand that, you know, you really understand that it's not about just getting that certification, but you actually train and become a very good diver, which I appreciated. So I definitely had to really sit down and practice. But man, it was awesome. It was very awesome. Just even watching her on days when I wasn't training, just watching her train other people, it was like, one day I'm going to do this. I'm going to train local people here, because that's actually something I want to do in the future, to actually bring more young people on the island into diving. I feel like when they do it, they may become better stewards or advocates for the ocean, which is what we need in this region. So I've definitely learned from her in that regard. She was pretty cool.
Yeah, she does. She does a lot of conservation work too in the community and stuff. You said you've developed a relationship with her. What's that bond been like?
It's been good. We talk a lot. I learn a lot, especially about the cave diving that she's doing now and how she's relating to local policymakers there and even the scientists there to kind of understand certain things in Bahamas. A lot of the things that the Bahamas is currently going through, we obviously have the same thing here in Jamaica, and we have those red tapes that we kind of have to go through in order to deal with things. So in that regard, I'm slowly understanding how things have to be done sometimes, and the steps that you can take, even though you'd want to do more, you can't. But to be able to push, she definitely fights to protect the environment, and I love that energy, and it's something that I want to emulate.
So, of course, you do a lot of diving for work, but do you do any fun diving outside of work?
They're all fun diving, actually.
It's all
that's,
fun.
That's the right answer.
I mean, a good answer.
It kind of is. I don't think there's ever been a dive that wasn't fun. I think the only time I ever felt overwhelmed is when I do the cleanup dives, because it's frustrating. I mean, when you're taking up shoes and toilet covers and stuff, it's like, okay, it's a fun dive, but at the same time you're kind of like, dude, why are you throwing this stuff in the ocean? So I think that's probably the closest to not being a fun dive.
Diving in Jamaica is a popular tourist activity for sure. Is diving a popular local pastime, and if so, what's the local diving community like?
It's definitely not something that's popular, although I have seen that from when I was a child growing up, there's increase in popularity. I suppose that helps. When I was younger, you would find that a lot more tourists or expats were the ones that were diving more so than locals. You find that there are a lot more, even of the marine bio students or those who are interested in science, they're doing the diving, even if not getting the formal certification, they're, you know, trying something. And we're encouraging them to, you know, at least get open water, which a lot of them are. I suppose a part of the stumbling block, at least two of them that I can say for sure, is cost. And then there's the, I guess, somehow general fear sometimes of drowning. That's one of the popular ones I've heard. But it's getting better. I mean, even swimming, we never used to have a lot of kids joining swim teams, and now it's like a lot. So we're getting somewhere. As far as the diving community here, it's pretty close. I mean, we're a small island, so it's kind of hard not to kind of have a relationship with everybody. And everybody's pretty nice, just like globally. I think if you dive, you automatically become this inclusive, fun person. It's impossible not to be super dope as a diver. So it's kind of the same here. It's almost as if, like, once you touch the water, you're like, troubles are gone and you're okay again.
When we spoke before the interview, you had mentioned that you dive with one or two local dive shops.
So mostly I've been going with Yardie Divers. They go out of Port Royal, which is here in Kingston. So it's closer to where I live. So that helps. But most recently, I've been mostly going to Portland, which biasly is my favorite parish. And they have a dive shop out there called Lady Godiva. And they kind of operate out of Alligator Head Foundation, which kind of helps to do some of the coral conservation efforts that are happening. So get to kill two birds with one stone going out with them.
We might have to follow up with you on that, see if we can get them on the podcast as well.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to.
Now, what's your absolute favorite dive site there? And can you swim us through a dive?
Absolute dive site. That's kind of hard to pick. Oh, I was afraid of this question. Ah, I honestly, I'm really thinking and I can't pick. I probably have to say Trident Wall only because Trident Hotel is one of those hotels that I think almost everyone wants to go to. Doing a wall dive is one of the best dives, especially if you already can control your buoyancy. It kind of helps and it sort of lets you brush the dirt off your shoulder a little bit when you realize that you're actually pretty good with your buoyancy. And I suppose it does help that because they've been sort of taking care of the area, you do have pretty good schools of fish that are hanging around. So that sort of helps too. So if I had to pick, probably there.
Yeah, it's hard to beat a good wall dive.
Yeah. I think it's more of the feeling of mastering certain skills that you're like, yeah, this is awesome.
Nice.
It's good to challenge yourself for sure. Well, I really appreciate that. We're going to run to a quick commercial break and be back with more from Janelle Williams. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. In these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge, big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com.
Welcome back to Dive in the Podcast. We're speaking to Jamaican scientist and diver Janelle Williams. You're a scientist at the International Center for Environmental and Nuclear Sciences. If we met at a cocktail party, how would you describe your job?
Well, I'd probably first have to tell people that, no, I don't make bombs, because for some reason, that's the first thing that everyone thinks because they hear nuclear and immediately think of bombs. So I suppose how I'd say it is I use nuclear to help study the environment to support conservation efforts.
Can you explain a little bit more like how the science works behind that nuclear technique?
So the nuclear technique that I apply here is called instrumental neutron activation analysis. So in simple terms, it's kind of like using the research reactor to tap into the atoms of specific things. In my case, I've been looking at both sargassum and sediment. So for sediments, when I tap into that atom using the research reactor, I'm able to find out elemental content, which kind of helps me to do a couple things. I can use it to date the sediment, so I can know when that deposition occurred. I can know that heavy metal presence, which kind of helps me to know if an area is polluted, and perhaps even identify the source of that pollution. That information is kind of what I use to kind of create a picture to feed into the conservation efforts, because they're trying to protect certain areas. We're trying to broaden the capacity of marine protected areas here. And a part of doing that, especially through the sustainability development goals, is kind of tapping into, one, what's causing the pollution, two, how can we fix the pollution issue? And to do that, you need data. And so kind of that's where I come in, to kind of help to feed that data.
So how does diving fit into all of this? Or do you spend more time in a lab?
For my job specifically, I'm mostly in the lab, but I'm working on fixing that because I try to convince them that I need to dive so I can get my samples. But I do go out to go and collect samples. So like when we had the sargassum blooms, I went out to both collect the sargassum samples and also to kind of collect some sediment samples, which I collect through diving. Diving is less so for work and more so for me to connect with those who are doing those conservation efforts. I don't believe science happens in a bubble. It has to be connected. There's no point in me doing research for the sake of doing research if it doesn't actually help the problems on the ground. So through diving, I'm able to have a greater appreciation for what is needed and what is missing. And so I try to tailor the work that I do to help to support those gaps.
That's really interesting. Do a fuller picture and, you know, tie all the loose ends together for sure.
Yeah.
Could you walk us through a typical day when you're out in the field collecting samples?
Sure. Most recently, when I was collecting sargassum samples, it's basically loading up the igloos, you know, the typical field supplies here, loading the vehicle, getting out at 6 a.m. because traffic in Jamaica is crazy. I like field work, though, because we're out. We're mostly on the coastline because I'm doing water or marine-based samples. Getting wet, which is no problem for me. Keeping those samples cool. Bringing them back to the lab and kind of prepping them. There isn't a lot out there in the field when I'm not diving. If I'm diving, then I'm usually staying by like Discovery Bay Marine Lab, setting up the day before and going out with some of their scientists there. When I had to collect samples for sediments in Discovery Bay, that's what I did. I worked with one of the scientists and head divers there, Camilo Trench, which is, he's doing awesome work on mangroves here in Jamaica. We went out together to collect sediment samples there so we could kind of compare them to what's going on here in Kingston.
So sargassum is one project you've been involved in. If I'm not mistaken, we talked a little bit about invasive lionfish.
Yes, but I wasn't a part of that project, but the team here at iSense did. My direct supervisor was actually a part of that. It's kind of a way how we use the techniques here to kind of understand what's going on. As you guys know, you know, the lionfish was a huge problem here in the region and to some extent still is. And so they kind of applied the science to kind of understand what's in the fish. And so it kind of helped when people were looking at it to eat. They went in it with a more educated standpoint from, okay, this isn't going to kill anyone as long as it's prepared properly. So similarly with the sargassum, Irish moss is a big thing out here. It's supposedly going to help you get certain vitamins. It helps when you get a cold. That's the only part that I know for sure works. And so with sargassum, because it looks similar to the average person, they're taking it and blending it and having it, you know, as a smoothie, just like they would Irish moss. And that could be a problem. So we're kind of using the science to kind of understand what's in it. They've already found that there are high levels of arsenic, which could be a problem. So we're doing speciation to kind of look to see how much of a problem that is. Does it vary across different species? And take it from there. Because they're already using it, not just for drink, but in Mexico, they're using it in cocktails. Some people are using it for soil amendment. They've been using it to make textbooks, like the covers of books. So they're already using it in the field, but I suppose a greater understanding of what's in it is needed.
Is there like a concern regarding heavy metals in the water, either in Jamaica or in the wider Caribbean?
Not specifically. I know that they're aware of pollution in general. For here, we've experienced a lot of oil spills over the past couple of decades. And so a part of the work that I'm trying to lead here to try and understand is the impact on the ecosystem in that regard. Because unlike the US or countries in Europe, we don't have data. We know intuitively that there is an issue. We know sporadically, you know, they may have issues with probably mercury or copper in certain areas where they've had mining. There's no data to support there's any specific problem here, but we don't really have the data to say yes or no just yet. So that's what we're trying to do to kind of fill those gaps, not just to find the bad stuff, but to be able to find out when something happens. I mean, if we were supposed to have an event, another oil spill or an event that's caused from some kind of transshipment of a certain type of material, we won't know how much it affected the area if we don't know the baseline. So it's from that standpoint that we're trying to cover all the bases.
Obviously, conservation's like a big part of your life. So what are some of the other local efforts that you've been involved in?
So personally, I've been trying to kind of push the whole urban farming. Kingston is basically Jamaica's New York. So it's very much like a concrete jungle. So I've been trying to kind of get the kids in my neighborhood to kind of know how to grow little stuff in their backyards. We don't have, you know, nice big lawns or anything. So we've been growing potatoes in paint buckets, trying to grow sweet potatoes. Sweet peppers and like have herbs and stuff. So that's one thing that's important to me. Trying to get my parents to compost more. That's a challenge, but we're making progress. But outside of that, it's just in general, trying to just be a good citizen. I mean, being an islander, it's quite impossible not to try and be a champion for the environment. I mean, you live in it. You can't not try to protect it. So I try to cover the bases as best as I can. I know that I'm far away from doing all the right things, but you know.
One of the other things that you'd mentioned to us, and you sent us a picture for our cover art for the episode, was the coral outplanting. What's that all about, or how's that work where you are?
Oh, yeah. So Alligator Head Foundation, among other groups here, they do outplanting of corals and mangroves a couple of times a year. I try to volunteer as best as I can to try and help them. They always need extra divers to help put out some of these corals or mangroves. So with that project, the staghorn corals, they get damaged from hurricanes and stuff, and so they fall over. So what they do is basically a couple of times a year, once they're treated, they go outplant them into protected areas and then allow the area to grow up. They actually posted a video recently to show that they've settled quite well. So I can send that to you guys so you can kind of see. But outside of that, even the mangrove efforts, it took a while for some areas to help because, you know, outplanting projects are quite hard. You'd put out 500 plants and probably only 20 survive. So it's quite difficult, which is why it's good not to disturb them in the first place. But you have teams here. Although small, they're valiant in their efforts to try and really get things going locally.
Early in the interview, you mentioned, you know, as a goal, wanting to sort of, you know, teach the next generation to dive and sort of, you know, appreciate the environment and the ocean. One of the things you sort of brought up was, you know, for yourself and also for, you know, the local dive community, that cost is an access issue. Like how do you see that playing out? How do you see that resolving itself if you want to get more people into diving?
Well, the dive cost definitely is a factor. I know that it's not going to necessarily be resolved from the aspect that if we're going to get certified, that's through PADI, that's a whole independent organization. But if we can have more, I guess, those who have it to help fund someone else, or even those marine organizations here that help to certify, if they can help to subsidize costs because they may have backers for their groups, there are avenues to it. For me personally, I'm trying to raise the capital so I can at least do one or two. If I can do that, then we're better off than zero. So that's kind of how I'm personally approaching it, that if I can just get one more person who can then in the future help another person, you know, we get on that way. And I suppose if all of us who are divers here help to support another diver, then we're a little bit further along. And I mean, outside of that, it's not just with diving. I just kind of want to get more kids around that environment. The marine labs here in Port Royal and Discovery Bay have had these really awesome summer camps where they have kids in different age groups that come by and they have an opportunity to learn about marine science. And while they don't get to dive, they get to go out in the field and kind of understand the ecosystem of a mangrove and kind of see some of the things in the fish tank. And for some of them, this is their first encounter with that kind of science and they're intrigued by it. And I mean, that little seed has been planted and you never know where that can go. So in that same way, I kind of wanted to be able to do something similar.
Yeah, it sounds similar to one of our recent guests, Weldon Wade in Bermuda.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And, you know, his programs that he's trying to, you know, get people more connected to the ocean so that they can better conserve it and just be, you know, more informed citizen growing up. And, you know, if you're like that from a child. Yeah, I don't know. It just seems like something that has to be worked on a lot of places. And I always wonder, too, if the dive organizations that make a lot of money off of tourists coming places and diving shouldn't be more obligated to help feed that reciprocal loop that, you know, sorry, I'm just rambling on, I guess.
But, oh, no, man, I definitely agree. And to some extent, some of them do. I think a part of it is kind of getting the information out there, because there are a lot of things that I'm just finding out now that I'm in this field that apparently existed before and I didn't know. And I think that's a huge problem, not just in Jamaica, but I think regionally, almost as if for you to be in on something, you kind of have to know someone, and that kind of sucks. So I think if we can kind of break down that sort of wall as well, it kind of helps.
Diving is definitely a thing. Like, the, you know, the more you're in it, the more you find out and the more people you meet and the more you connect, and, you know, you kind of go from there. But I think that's a very interesting point you made, that, like, you know, if that information isn't available to people who aren't aware to start with, then how do you become inspired by it, or, you know, interested in it? So I guess maybe you have a starting point for that seed to grow.
True. I mean, I had TV. It was cable. It was Nat Geo and Discovery Channel. I mean, that was my in. For someone else, it may very well be this podcast, you know? I mean, you never know. With social media, a lot of people are being connected with things now. You had the Black in Marine Science Week, I believe it was late last year. And that was like a huge catalyst, it seemed, for a lot of people who didn't even realize it was a thing. So I think as we go along, I mean, as we discover new podcasts, because podcast has been a big thing for me in the last couple of months, you get to discover things that apparently everyone else knew existed and you were the only one who apparently didn't seem to know. But it helps. I mean, you guys are doing the Lord's work here. I get all the cool tips at the end of your shows. I get to realize that people who live halfway across the world have similar interests, sometimes even similar backgrounds. And I mean, that's, for me at least, that feels good. It was kind of one of the reasons I got hooked to the show, because even though I may not do the exact same thing, I mean, we all have the same passion for the ocean. We're all excited, you know, to go out and put on our wetsuits, which is why COVID really sucks, because we can't go out as much as we want to. Mm-hmm. But at least you can listen to the stories. So that helps.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I think that's one of my favorite parts of the show too, just being a host, just getting to meet people all over the world and realizing, yeah, we're really not all that different. Share the same passion.
Definitely.
Janelle, where can we find you on social media so we can stay in touch?
I'm on Instagram mostly at Island Girl Finding Her Way. It's the same for Twitter, except the Finding Her Way is FHW. I called it that because I'm literally just an island girl trying to figure out this life and kind of, you know, do the best that I can. So I figured it summed me up pretty well. So yes, IG at Island Girl Finding Your Way, and Twitter, same thing.
Sounds like you're on the right track for sure.
Yeah. Thanks.
Janelle, what keeps you diving?
Honestly, the ocean brings me absolute peace. It's one of the few places that no matter what's happening, I can almost always shed it the minute some body part touches the water. Sometimes just listening to the ocean, it's like there's a level of peace that I can't even describe. So if anything else, it's that.
That's awesome.
We can all relate. Yeah.
100%. Well, coming up next is our Think Blue segment with Nick.
In this Think Blue segment, we're going to start taking a little bit of a different direction from the usual Think Blue segments. Up to now, we've been talking about tips and tricks and sort of advice for how divers can sort of lessen their impact on the marine environment. And we'll still do a bit of that, but we kind of want to use this space too to maybe raise some more awareness and talk about the oceans in more general terms. So one of the things I want to do is talk about some cool species that people might encounter, and maybe some more obscure species that people might encounter and not know what they, what their roles are and what they mean. If anybody's dived in the Caribbean, they've probably seen the really long spined sea urchins. They're called Diadema. And they're really notable because whereas most sea urchin spines are between 1 and 3 centimeters long, Diadema have these massive spines. They're about 10, 12 centimeters in length. And in the large individuals, they can get much longer than that. They live pretty shallow, sort of in the first 10 meters, 30 feet, usually on coral reefs and near seagrass beds. You know, they're impressive and they're beautiful, and you certainly don't want to step on them. But they are really important because one of the things that Diadema does in tropical reefs is that they're grazers. Diadema, like other sea urchins, they have this structure underneath in the mouth called the Aristotle's lantern, and that's what they use to sort of graze. And that grazing is important because they are eating seaweed, right, off the bottom. And their presence actually helps keep the hard substrate clean. And by doing that, it minimizes competition between for space between algae and other hard organisms that are living on the bottom, like corals. And it's especially important because if you remove things like grazers, sea urchins are one of them, but also things like parrotfish, you end up overgrowing. You end up with growth of algae on the reef that then when coral is spawning, the little coral larvae, when they're ready to settle, they have nowhere to settle because it's covered in that green seaweed. And also, seaweed grows faster than coral, so then it will outcompete coral on the reef for space and start choking it off. So if you go on a reef and you see that it's covered in algae when it's supposed to be covered in coral, chances are there's some sort of imbalance with a grazer, but there's also other factors too. So Diadema, a very iconic species in the Caribbean, very important. They went through a massive die-off in the 80s, and they've not recovered since. So you still see them, but not in numbers that they used to be. So that's one of the things you might see on a dive that's, you know, fairly obvious, but it's not so like charismatic megafauna, but has a huge importance for reefs.
Yeah, I never realized until I had a reef aquarium that, you know, everything has a job. And when you try to have part of that without everything else doing its job, it's like impossible. So, you know, it's like a problem in reef aquariums. You get too much algae growing because you don't have anything to eat the algae. So you go, and then, you know, you have to get urchins. You have to get all the, yeah, everybody's got a job.
Yeah, and reef systems in themselves, they're super complex. And because they live in nutrient-poor environments, which is why the visibility is so good, they've actually gotten really good at, the system's gotten really good at transferring nutrition between species and between different animals. But yeah, you take one out and the balance just kind of changes and the reef changes really quickly too.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you very much, Nick. I like the new direction. Interested to learn about something next time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to always talk to people about what they should do either. I hope people can recognize that on their own type of thing, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Well, next in the agenda is the travel segment. And, you know, I still feel weird about talking about travel in this kind of time, but we're going to talk about Aruba. I've been to 2 of the 3 of the Dutch Antilles there, the Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao. And so we're going to chat about those over the next coming segments. So as a brief overview, Aruba is the most grown up. You'll find chain restaurants in tower-style beach resorts and the largest population. Bonaire is largely known as the diver's island. It has great diving, but mostly people traveling around, you know, renting Jeeps and diving full-time on Bonaire. Yes, see, as for Curaçao, it's a nice mix of, you know, kind of medium-sized population and great diving. Well, it's great diving on all three islands. Aruba has some cool wrecks. I only have a short amount of time, so I'm just going to chat about a couple of wrecks because that's what Amit loves the most. The first one that comes to mind is the Antilla. The Antilla is a ship that was in World War II. It was literally just was parked in the offshore. And when the Germans invaded Holland, the boat's captain actually got everybody off the ship because the Germans were going to take over the ship. And then he turned up all the boilers, closed all the cooling mechanisms, and then ran like heck, and the ship exploded in the bay just off of shore. So now there's a wreck in 10 meters, 30 feet, water. It's a 100 or 400 foot long wreck, a 122 meter wreck. So it's a good size, but you can literally snorkel it. And if the tide's low, I think you can practically stand up on it. Makes for really fun diving and night diving. Literally did a night dive there once, and the dive master that they assigned us couldn't find the wreck. We were right next to this 400 foot wreck. Anyway, it was really hilarious after the dive. There's a the Jane Sea is another one. It's a lot deeper. It's about 90 feet. It's, you've probably, if you've seen pictures of wreck dives from Aruba, you've definitely seen pictures of this trawler. It's 250 feet long, 76 meters, like I said, and about 90 feet of water. And, you know, you just lots of life there because it's been there for a long time. And last thing I want to chat about is they have a few planes sunk around the island as artificial reefs. The one I've dove personally is the DC-3. It seems like really cool to dive on a plane, and it's neat and weird to see a fully intact plane underwater. But then you swim through the fuselage, you realize how boring a plane is. I'm happy to have done it and definitely recommend it. But yeah, it's nice dive. Definitely so many nice dives there. So anyway, Aruba has lots of beautiful reefs and lots of other diving. But that's about all the time I have for today. If you're able to, Aruba is technically able for or open for travel at this time. At the time of this recording, you have to do a pretest or a test when you get there. But I'd rather pan for post-pandemic travel and not chance anything. So we'll see you next time on the travel segment when we chat about Curaçao. That does it for today's episode. I want to thank you again, Janelle, for being on the episode tonight. It was a lot of fun, and I really appreciated everything you had to share with us.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. It was nice talking to you.
It was definitely a blast. And Nick, I want to thanks for setting this all up and getting this going.
Like I said every week, it's been a pleasure, and it's been a pleasure chatting with Janelle. And I know Amit, who's originally from Trinidad, was sad to miss out today, but he's going to be at work. So we'll say thank you on behalf of Amit as well.
Okay.
And April, thanks for everything tonight.
Yep, thanks for having me. And Janelle, it was very nice to meet you. And hopefully at some point when the world opens back up, we can get down to Jamaica and see you sometime and go for some dives.
Sounds like a plan. I'm holding you guys to that, actually.
Yeah, well,
we'll stop on our world tour.
well, you know, well done. You know, like enticed us with some swizzle and and what was it?
It was like chili, wasn't it?
Chili, yeah. So, what did you entice us with? Food-wise?
That's nothing. Like, you can get jerk lionfish. So one, you get really good food while helping the environment. I can throw in, you know, some really nice sightings of stingrays, maybe even reef sharks. I can throw in just a good vibe. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. You may even run into Usain Bolt. I mean, like, you can have so many opportunities when you're here.
There you go. I knew I could bait you with that question.
Awesome. You'll be fed. That much I can promise.
We'll That's half there. The battle won.
Yep. Before we leave tonight, we should thank our Patreon supporters. Tonight's thanks goes out to Al. Thanks, Al, for being a generous supporter of Dive in the Podcast. Be sure to check out our Patreon for more information. You can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @DiveInPod. Our email is diveinthepodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, www.diveinpod.com. On our website, you'll find episodes, details on our reoccurring segments, merch, and more. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert. Nick is at Nicholas Winkler Photography. You can find links for everything we mentioned on today's episode in the show notes or on our website, diveinpod.com. Next week, we speak to Dr. Sonia Rowley. She's an evolutionary marine biologist and dive soft ambassador who uses rebreathers to conduct research in the depths of the ocean. This episode of Dive in the Podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba. Head over to your favorite podcast app to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.